big issues are gripping the investors' world. And of course, the main question is how to capitalize on those issues. Today, we're talking with Raj Chand, Client Portfolio Manager at Jennison Associates, about two of these issues, both close to his heart. AI on the one hand and decarbonization on the other. Are they related, and how about investing in those themes? We'll ask Raj. Raj, welcome to the show. It's great to have you again.
Thank you very much for having me.
Raj, you visited the FONTS event this year and you actually led one of the breakout sessions. And the topic of the event was AI, friend or foe. Now, for starters, I'd like to know your position on this ongoing debate. Do you consider AI mainly as a risk or do you see it mainly as an opportunity?
It's a great question. And let me start by saying that we see AI as a huge change. So generative AI has actually been around since you could program your digital alarm clock back in the 80s. I never learned to program my video recorder. But generative AI is a huge breakthrough. We regard it as the fourth major age of the computing revolution, a big step forward in our advance into the information age. But like all major breakthroughs from humanity, it's got its positives and it's got lots of promise, but it's also got lots of risks. So, you know, if you think about fire, it was exactly the same. If you fast forward a few millennia to the nuclear, to atomic fission, you know, we can power whole cities and towns with it. We can destroy cities and towns with it. Of course, AI has the capacity to be used for bad things, for criminal things, for to really advance the cause of nation states that want to do bad things. But it also has the power to help us develop new cures for diseases, new solutions to problems we've wrestled with for centuries. So I would say it has to be both. And from an investment perspective, the key isn't sort of saying, well, how much is opportunity and how much is threat? It's how do you manage those risks? And also, how do you make sure you're putting yourself in the right position to harvest those opportunities?
Yeah, let's focus on that. I think indeed people would like to know how to harvest those opportunities because managing risks is a whole nother discussion. But Raj, how do you determine then where, how and when AI will actually create value?
Well, I would say, this is not what investors normally say, I'd say it's almost impossible to say what AI will be used for and where the value creation will be in 3, 4, 5 years' time. We're so limited by our own imaginations and by the past. So, of course, it's going to get used across a very wide range of industries. And the analogy that I really like in that context is that if you had a field, a track of athletes who are going to run a race, and you know they've all got their different abilities and training, and you find that there is a drug that can improve performance by 25%. If you give it to all those athletes, then actually the outcome will be exactly the same. The best athlete will still win. They'll all just finish 25% faster. And so it is with AI that if every retailer in the Benelux region starts to use AI to improve their efficiency and their logistics and their supply chain, actually, they'll all improve by roughly the same amount, depending on how effectively they use it. So you just can't tell. It won't give you any indication of who the winners will be. All you can say for sure is, in that competitive situation, the players that don't take the drug, the players that don't basically learn to surf the wave of AI, are the ones that will get crushed. So at that level, you say, you know, either learn to surf the wave or get crushed by the wave. Now, what we're saying is that at this point in time, in late 2023, the visible bit of value creation is in the infrastructure layer, because that's the bit that's enabling all this growth. And we feel that people will be trying a lot of different applications, whether it's a media company or a podcast company, whether it's a retailer or a healthcare company, we'll all be trying lots of different applications. Some will work, some won't. So we don't know how the applications will work, but the enabling of that generative AI power is where the real value creation at the moment and for the next year or two will really be.
Yeah. So there is a lot of uncertainty, right? There's a lot of unknown about the way in which AI will actually create that value. Are there any certainties that you can mention?
Yes. So when you go into that infrastructure layer, you know, the whole breakthrough of generative AI, science fiction writers have been talking about it for over half a century. Certainly we've had basic AI. And as I say, you know, even my chess computer when I was a kid was a form of AI.
Yeah.
The idea of generative AI is creating these very large language models that have billions of inputs and then use machine learning to create new, to generate new content that didn't exist before. Now, to do that, that's only really become possible with these very highly advanced chips, these GPUs. The NVIDIA in particular are manufacturing. You really can see there's a shortage of those, and it's quite visible that that shortage will persist through next year at least. Then all the companies that help them, the chip design companies, and it's a very specialist field, the chip manufacturing companies, the ones that make the very high-end equipment, and then also, you know, when you use, and maybe many of our listeners have used ChatGPT or the free version of it at least, when you put in a question, it's not your phone or your iPad or your laptop or even your desktop that's then calculating the answer. Your question is going off to the cloud, to a data center. That's where the huge computing power, this multi-billion parameter large language model then crunches. And then several seconds later, you get your answer. So those data centers will all need to upgrade to this much higher quality, much higher speed and power GPU-enabled infrastructure. The demand for those chips, therefore, looks far in excess of supply. You then have demand for those data centers and their capacity growing very rapidly. Because as people adopt a generative AI, and they're adopting it at a record level, faster than any other innovation we've had before, then they themselves are trying to expand and build more data centers, get more chips, advanced chips to populate those data centers to enable the infrastructure that allows us to use AI. So there are quite a few areas where we think there is going to be more demand than there will be supply for the foreseeable future. And, you know, the cloud infrastructure companies like Microsoft Azure, Amazon's AWS, Google Cloud, they themselves are finding that adding more data centers is problematic because it requires a huge amount of energy. And I know that quite recently in Holland, an application was turned down because there were concerns in that region that the grid wouldn't be able to cope. And it requires a huge amount of water because these data centers get hot and you need to cool them down. And so, you know, it's not going to be a smooth and easy process, but we do think that there is visible value creation happening right now in that enabling infrastructure and software layer. And then we'll see over the next few years which applications are the real big winners.
Yeah. So I start to see the link now, indeed. So AI needs huge quantities of energy and water, like you just said. And I guess this is the link to your other big interest that I mentioned in the introduction, climate and decarbonization. Does it have a negative impact on our emission levels, AI?
I think if you look at it very short term, you could argue that it does. But in reality, I think it is very much a two-way street. So the negative contribution, as we've just discussed, is that these data centers is where all the computing really takes place. And they consume a lot of energy and they require a lot of water. And so in the first instance, as we need to build more data centers and power them up with the latest infrastructure, that is a negative. But of course, AI also offers the possibility of finding solutions to problems that have puzzled engineers and scientists for ages. You know, we have lots of processes in the world where the engineers know, or believe at least, that there could be far better, more energy efficient ways of doing the same thing. Using AI to apply it to whole processes or parts of processes could solve problems that puzzled us for generations. So the ability to use the power of AI to help us improve and reimagine and rethink everyday processes, manufacturing, services, is a huge potential upside for humanity as we all strive to, you know, get to that place we all want to get to, which is a low carbon economy, but without sacrificing a big sacrifice in standards of living. Right. And AI could be a really important ally, a really important part of that.
Right. Meanwhile, what we're seeing is that investing in decarbonization is well on its way, so to speak. We see EVs, renewable energy, grids. Seems like it's looking good.
No.
It's not. Not looking good.
It's not looking good. So if you look at the world, we're not making much progress.
Okay.
So, you know, if you look at the humanity's scorecard, so we've the science has been around for decades. Certainly over the last decade or two, we've kind of collectively, broadly come to the consensus we want to reduce our carbon emissions. And yet, actually, we're not making much progress. So part of the reason why lies in the question that you asked, because, you know, around the world, we've got trillions of euros invested into these carbon, climate, energy transition kind of thematic investment portfolios. And yet they focus on those very visible things like renewables, solar and wind, like electric vehicles and battery technology. But that cannot be the whole solution. To get from where we are today to the low carbon economy, you need so many more activities, so many parts of our daily lives change, that actually that focus, that narrow focus, although those areas are all very important as a part of our journey, it's just the tip of the iceberg. And if you're familiar with that analogy or metaphor of icebergs, usually the bit that you see at the tip is only 10%, and yeah, what is below the waterline is 90%. So if you think about airline travel, if you think about the building you're sitting in, all the glass you see every day, all the cement, all the steel, there are so many things we need to address that are very carbon intensive. Our food chain, the way that we grow and feed ourselves, we unnecessarily huge amounts of carbon emissions. So there's a lot really that we need to think about. But most important is that I think our industry, the investment industry, the regulators, and indeed the policymakers, by focusing on that narrow tip of the iceberg, and it is more than 10% of the solution, it's probably only half the solution there. By focusing so narrowly, they're missing many other parts that are very, very important.
I get it. So you're pledging for a more broad approach. Could you tell us what that approach would then look like?
Yes. So That's really where we think we're approaching the issue differently, because we're saying that this focus on having companies that have the lowest current emissions or just reducing their emissions from quarter to quarter or year to year is too narrow. And our broader picture is then saying, well, let's think about those companies that are helping avoid emissions. So if you think about where we are today as point A, and we want to make this journey, and it's going to be a tough journey, and we haven't done a great job so far as a planet, as a race, to point B, which is that low carbon economy, a lot of that is going to have to be emissions avoided. And that doesn't really come into the regulations or the policy frameworks. And, you know, let me make that more concrete for you with a kind of example. And there's a stock that we have in the portfolio, which is sort of like this, but as a schematic, imagine I am a consulting company and I go to you and to our listener and your companies and help you to dramatically reduce your emissions. I give you advice on your insulation, your windows, using sensors for your lights, changing your air conditioning, in buildings, in factories, in whole towns and cities. Now, I'm making a business out of decarbonization. You may only be doing it to reduce your costs, but you may be doing it to reduce your carbon footprint. But what's really interesting in the current way that people think about this is that, you know, as my business grows, I may be hiring more consultants. They may be traveling to more sites to advise more clients on more projects. Now, the emissions being avoided as a result of those activities is growing and growing. But my own company's emissions rise rather than fall. So I wouldn't be eligible for 99% of all the strategies that are in this kind of space at the moment. And, you know, there are many examples like this where we think the market, the regulators, investors are missing and really important contributors to decarbonization. And so our idea is that if you think more broadly, your investment universe grows enormously. You can have many different ways, many more ways of investing into this decarbonization theme.
Yeah. Yeah. So would you say it includes, for instance, big energy companies as well?
Yes. I mean, I think that's an interesting question, because we would say we do not exclude the big energy companies. But they end up excluding themselves from the way we approach this, because, you know, for any important theme, any thematic investment, you need a threshold to say, you know, below this level of exposure, maybe it isn't really a good play on that, this theme. And so we set a limit of 30%. We say if a company doesn't have at least 30% of revenues or profits or capex coming directly from some form of decarbonization activity, it can be direct decarbonization like renewables, or it could be avoiding emissions or helping others avoid emissions, then we won't consider it. So most major energy companies don't meet that 30% threshold. But there are some that do, because some, generally not surprising that the more European ones invest heavily into renewables. And that's obviously very clear. And more controversially, also investing more into gas.
Yeah. That's an interesting one, yeah.
Yeah,
because gas and the merits of gas are not widely accepted, right? Especially not in the Netherlands, I'd say. How do you look at that?
Yeah, I welcome this opportunity to talk to the listeners in the Netherlands, because I would say if you care about the climate, if you care about carbon emissions, then scientifically, the fact is the number one enemy for all of us that do care about that should be coal.
Right.
And that's still a big issue for the world today. Right now, as we speak, and probably unless somebody's listening to this in 5 years' time or 10 years' time, when the listener is listening to this, 30% of all the energy humans generate on the planet today will come from coal. 30%. That's 40% of all the electricity generated in the world today. And 50% of all the carbon emissions humans will put into the environment. Now, coal isn't just like 10% or 20% dirtier than gas. It's many times dirtier than gas. So everywhere you can replace coal with gas, you get a massive improvement. When I say massive, it is the equivalent of, you know, anybody who will ever listen to this podcast never traveling by aeroplane or car ever again, and turning vegan. The one coal-fired power station shutting down in favor of a gas-fired power station is millions of tons of carbon emissions saved over the lifetime of that power station for the same amount of energy. So I want to be controversial. I want to be provocative because we believe this very strongly. For people who say they care about the climate, to say they oppose more gas production is both mathematically and scientifically illiterate. Every country where you improve the supply and availability of gas, you reduce the usage of coal, and that allows people to decarbonize whilst improving standards of living. That is how Europe has reduced its carbon emissions over the last 15 years while still growing its GDP. That's why that's happened in the US. And if you take, and we can't avoid the elephant in the room, the elephants in the room, which is China and India, huge populous countries. They have very low emissions compared to Europe or the US per person. And they're industrializing, they're growing. And so they need power for that. And at the moment, they're still building new coal-fired power stations because that is what is cheap and abundant. If we can ensure that they feel confident they will get reliable supplies of gas, that will be a huge win for the planet. We see gas as a decarbonization fuel for the next several years, although, of course, there will come a time when coal usage has dropped a lot, when we then have to think about phasing out gas for lower carbon fuels. But right now, the next steps in this journey involve replacing coal with gas. And the steps after that, we should address when the time comes.
Very clear examples. And I love the illustration that you do with the numbers. And it really gives a much broader perspective. Thank you so much, Raj, for being here with us and for sharing your views on the two major issues. We learned about the uncertainty surrounding the value creation with AI. We must ride the wave, but where it will take us, we don't know. And we value your advice regarding the decarbonization. Don't fool yourself with looking only at the top of the iceberg. It's such a huge and profound transition. We also need to value the avoided emissions. This podcast is part of a series dedicated to the FONS event 2023. Theme of the series is AI, Friend or Foe. For more information and other podcasts, please visit the website of Investment Officer, investmentofficer.nl. Thank you for listening.
Disclaimer: for professional investors only, all investments involve risk, including the possible loss of capital. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The views expressed in this document are of PGIM as of September 2023 and may not be reflective of their current opinions and are subject to change without notice. Neither the information contained herein nor any opinion expressed shall be construed to constitute investment advice or as an offer to sell or a solicitation to buy any securities mentioned herein. Any projections or forecasts presented herein are subject to change. This commentary does not purport to provide any legal, tax, or accounting advice. Certain information in this commentary has been obtained from sources believed to be reliable as of the date presented. However, we cannot guarantee the accuracy of such information, assure its completeness, or warrant such information will not be changed. The information contained herein is current as of the date of issuance, or such earlier date as referenced herein, and is subject to change without notice. In the European Economic Area, EEA, information is issued by PGIM Netherlands BV with registered office, Gustav Mahlerlaan 1212, 1081 LA Amsterdam, the Netherlands. PGIM Netherlands BV is authorized by the Autoriteit Financiële Markten, AFM, in the Netherlands, registration number 15003620, and operating on the basis of a European passport. In certain EEA countries, information is, where permitted, presented by PGIM Limited in reliance of provisions, exemptions or licenses available to PGIM Limited under temporary permission arrangements following the exit of the United Kingdom from the European Union. These materials are issued by PGIM Limited and or PGIM Netherlands BV to persons who are professional clients as defined under the rules of the FCA and or to persons who are professional clients as defined in the relevant local implementation of Directive 2014/65/EU, MIFID II. Jennison Associates LLC, PGIM Limited, and PGIM Netherlands BV are wholly owned subsidiaries of PGIM Inc., the principal investment management business of Prudential Financial Inc. PFI. PFI of the United States is not affiliated in any manner with Prudential PLC, incorporated in the United Kingdom, or with Prudential Assurance Company, a subsidiary of M&G PLC, incorporated in the United Kingdom. Copyright 2023 Prudential Financial Inc., PFI, and its related entities. Jennison Associates, Jennison, the PGIM logo and the rock symbol are service marks of PFI and its related entities, registered in many jurisdictions worldwide.